Welcome to the Thriving Forward podcast. Now to introduce your hosts. Hi, I'm Megan Laspinera. I'm the founder and executive director of Kids Thrive 585 Inc. and a pediatrician in Rochester, New York.
And I'm Sarah Collins McGowan. I'm also a pediatrician here in Rochester, and I teach community health and advocacy to pediatric residents. In each episode, we will speak with people involved in good works and projects in the greater Rochester area. We hope that by introducing you to these inspirational people and their stories, you will be motivated to learn more about these amazing organizations in our region and the fabulous people who keep them working.
Hey everyone, this is Sarah, and today I'm here with Mitch Gruber, Chief Strategy Officer at FoodLink. In addition to his role with FoodLink, he's also a Rochester City Council member. Mitch, thanks for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
So we like to start our interviews with an icebreaker question. So what is something that you've been into lately?
Well, I just had my firstborn, which I think is probably very appropriate for this podcast. So I would say that what I'm into lately is going for long walks and pushing a stroller. It's a new thing for me, but I actually really enjoy it. It makes me think about the walk differently.
Yeah, when you're seeing it through somebody else's eyes, it really changes things. So I think that most people have heard of FoodLink, but may not know how extensive your operations are. So would you just start by talking about like the mission of FoodLink and some of the programs that you have?
Sure. So our mission is to leverage the power of food to build healthier communities. And I really want to focus on the word healthier there, because the history of food banking has not so much been related to public health, right? It's really been focused on a different H word, which is hunger. And for years, FoodLink is now in our 42nd year, and most food banks really start to form in the 1970s. And for the longest time, they were really just focused on how can we get more calories to people who aren't otherwise getting calories. And it was a matter of trying to save food from landfills, from manufacturers, from retailers, from wholesalers. It was also a matter of working with government agencies. So the USDA has surplus commodities. People probably remember the idea of government cheese back in the 70s. So food banks pop up in order to grab all of this food that's kind of abundant and is not hitting the retail shelves, and storing it and distributing it to a network of small nonprofit organizations that make up the emergency food network. We would call them food pantries or soup kitchens or homeless shelters. So, you know, organizations like FoodLink, that's really what we focused on for years. And around Rochester, we have this huge, huge food industry. I mean, this really is the breadbasket of New York State and beyond. It's no coincidence that right in our backyard here, we have Barilla, we have Ledestri, we have Mott's, Seneca Foods. I could go on and on. So as these producers either overproduce or misproduce, we take in that food and we work with several hundred nonprofit organizations that I was referring to. And of course, our biggest partner on the food end of things is Wegmans. For any of the retail stuff that they can't or won't sell, it comes into FoodLink, and again, we distribute it out. So that's the kind of history of food banking, if you will. It's not exactly the question you asked, but that's the way my brain works, is I like to start with the history of things. But what's changed over time is our real commitment to thinking about health and making sure that we're not just passing out whatever calories happen to come to us. And of course, we can talk about this, you know, as the podcast goes on, but the nature of the food system that we occupy in this country is one that overproduces unhealthy, overprocessed food and really hurts the production of fresh fruits and vegetables. So we have to be very strategic in how we think through how to prioritize healthy food. And that's where all of our different programs come in, which is probably what you want me to talk about at some point. But I'll stop there and assume that I at least sort of answered your question and see where you want to take the conversation from there.
I guess my next question is, how have you been able to make that shift? I imagine there are a lot of powerful forces that make that challenging in some ways. And so what have been the ways that FoodLink has been able to pivot towards health?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there are powerful forces, but you know, all of these things are, we can navigate all of them in different ways, but we continue to be an imperfect organization ourselves. You know, there's a whole lot more that we can do. And some of that is going to require action at a federal and state level, which we can get to later. But some of the ways that we've been able to pivot is simply making internal decisions and just standing by them. So a very clear example of that is that we no longer distribute soda. For many years, soda would come into our facility, and we would find places that wanted soda. And the reality is that a lot of places want soda because we have an appetite in this country for, you know, sugar sweetened beverages. On a quick aside, there's a constant criticism of you know, food stamps or SNAP benefits, that too much of it is used on soda and sugar sweetened beverages. But the reality is that everybody, whether you use SNAP benefits or otherwise, everybody in this country buys more soda than we probably ought to, right? So I want to be really clear that this is not just something that we made a decision about, you know, any one community or another. It's a health focused decision that said we want to stop distributing soda, which I think was you know, a smart thing for us to do. But there's the competing forces that you're talking about, Sarah, include you know, the idea that the tax benefit for donating fresh produce isn't there for folks the same way it is for donating, you know, maybe an extra truckload of pasta coming from Barilla. So here's an example of that, just to dive in to the weeds a little bit. You know, Wayne County, which is just to the east of us, is the biggest apple producing county in the entire eastern part of the United States. It's huge. It really is apple country, which is why Mott's is headquartered there. When an apple grower overproduces a certain variety, or whether the things are under sized or miscolored, or maybe there's a hailstorm, whatever the case may be, it's not fit for the retail. They don't look to donate that product because they can just sell it to Mott's, and Mott's will turn it into juice or sauce or whatever it is that doesn't require the cosmetic perfection. So that means that if we want apples from Wayne County Farms, then the reality is we need to figure out how to compete with a place like Mott's on their price for juice or sauce apples. And so that requires some strategy around fundraising. That requires some strategy around relationship building. And so over the years, we've gotten a lot better at that stuff to make sure that we can actually get in and receive those fresh apples from Wayne County and get them out to folks, because we know that, you know, an apple is a really, it's a powerful thing in this community, because not only does it keep the doctor away, but on top of that, it's also something that can actually store for a while. You know, one of the concerns about fresh produce in a food pantry is, you know, you give a food pantry a bunch of greens, for example, and within days they may not look so good, but apples have a storage capacity. So we need to be very competitive about getting apples. And that's one example of something we've done very well over the years.
Do you have also any sort of policy or advocacy arm as well to FoodLink? You're talking about certainly sort of local relationships and advocacy. Is that a piece of what you do also?
Yes, but much more so recently than in years past. I mean, there's generally a reluctance among nonprofits to advocate. I think that's, you know, that's something that comes directly from something called the Johnson Amendment at the federal level. We could geek out about that sometime if you'd like to, but there's been a reluctance of nonprofit organizations to advocate, and that includes food banks. We have decided over the last several years, as part of our strategic planning process, that we are going to be a whole lot more proactive about advocacy, and not just things that directly relate to food security and the work we do at FoodLink, but also things that indirectly relate to it. So just a quick example, we have always been advocates of SNAP program. And for those who don't know, SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. So it's essentially just dollars for people to be able to spend on food if they meet a certain poverty threshold. There is no doubt in my mind, or in FoodLink's mind, there's no doubt that SNAP is a more powerful anti-hunger program than anything that we can do as an organization, right? We know that, we advocate for it, and we have for a long time, and we will continue to. But what we've started to do a lot over the years, the last several years too, as part of this advocacy platform that we built out, is feel more comfortable advocating for other things that are tangentially related to, like housing stability. The reality is that if people are more stable in their housing, there's more of an opportunity for them to be food secure and for them to get the actual food and maintain the diet that you as a doctor want them to be able to maintain. When there's a ton of transients between houses or apartments, when there's a constant inability to be able to pay rent, that ultimately is going to have so many impacts on people's health and including on their diet. So we, over the years, 2 years ago now, there was a huge housing bill passed by the state legislature here in New York State. And that was one of the first spaces where FoodLink actually very formally got involved and said, we really believe in X, Y, and Z and in support of, you know, housing stability. So we will continue to become more of an advocacy organization because ultimately what we know is that policy is the most critical piece to being able to solve the issues that we're addressing in a long-term sustainable level.
To me, that's such an exciting shift to see. I think we're seeing it in medicine also, this greater recognition of, you know, all of the socioeconomic factors that go into health, or, you know, what's termed the social determinants of health. And, you know, much more of a push for physicians and healthcare providers to address and advocate also at a policy level for those things. And I think, you know, the same thing's happening in the education sphere. And so, you know, hearing that, you know, even in the work that you're doing, you're thinking about these other things, about housing, about other things that are affecting people's health, just to me sort of fits with what I'm seeing in all these other areas, which I think is really exciting.
It has to happen. I mean, there's no other way. And I'll just, you know, I'll use this, the little open door you gave me to just rant about something that's happening right now, which I'm sure you were going to get to eventually anyways, which is related to what's happening with COVID.
Yes, and that's my next question.
there you go. We're synced up then. Well, you know, the truth is that there's never been a greater need on for food in this community or across the country. And I just want to be really clear about that for a second. The need for food is not something that is, it's not specifically a need for food. I think that's a misconception that people have all the time. The reality is that as poverty continues to grow, and especially right now as we see unemployment rates continue to skyrocket and the federal stimulus package essentially dried up several months ago, what we're seeing is more and more people fall below the poverty threshold. As a matter of fact, the New York Times just did an article that in 3 months from August until now, basically 8 million new people in this country fell below the poverty line. I mean, it's truly staggering. And what I want people to understand is that it's not that when people all of a sudden don't have resources that food is the only thing that they need. On the contrary, food is often the only thing that they can get in a very sustained way. So we as a food bank network have a really robust system, right, across the country that I've already described a little bit, that, you know, shows how anybody in this community can find a food pantry or a hot meal program that will serve them. Meanwhile, there isn't a sophisticated charitable network to help people pay for their utility bills. There isn't a sophisticated charitable network to help people pay for their medicine or pay for their rent or fill their car with gas to get to work. None of those things exist. There is a charitable network for food. So people really enter the food system as a place where they can take a little bit of the burden off of them and their families. And what that means is that more and more of that burden falls on places like FoodLink. And, you know, look, we are happy to step up and serve. When I started at FoodLink, and I started right in the same year as our current CEO Julia Tedesco and our Chief Operating Officer Tara Keller, the three of us all kind of started together. We were an 8 million pound a year food bank. This year, we're going to end up distributing north of 24 million pounds. So in 12 years, we've more than tripled. And that's not something to be proud of, We're proud that we're able to meet the need. We're not proud that the community needs that much, but that is only scratching the surface. And the reality is, to get back to the point about advocacy, is that the federal and state governments have both put a lot into the food banking network over the past 8 months since COVID. They have really leaned into food banks. In particular, the federal government put over $1 billion into something they called the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, which is leading us to be able to do these drive-through distributions of pre-boxed fresh foods, you know, every week in every part of our service area, which is great. But what they should be doing is putting more money into people's pockets. They should have expanded SNAP benefits. They should find ways to make sure that people's unemployment benefits don't run out. Because the truth is, no matter what anyone wants to believe, the idea of supporting the charitable network is not as efficient as an expansion of SNAP benefits. And we have a long way to go in advocating for what's right and advocating for what needs to happen. And it's complicated, right? Because in the end, I think with most nonprofits, the goal is ultimately to put ourselves out of business, right? That's what we want to do. And that's hard, but advocacy is something that we need to continue to refine and hone in on and make sure that we're reaching out to people like you and to the medical community to make sure that our advocacy is actually in sync with the other providers who are thinking through the social determinants of health. And I look forward to continuing to do that work.
What have you seen locally in terms of changes in need with COVID or just changing how you've had to do your operations? Because that must have been a huge shift suddenly for the way that you guys have been distributing food.
Yeah. One of the really sad parts about the change in our operations that we've spent the last probably close to 10 years really encouraging our network of partners to really lean into client choice. So client choice means that if someone needs a food pantry, back in the 70s, it would have been you go to the church, someone meets you outside, hands you a box and says, you know, call me if you need more food. But that box may include peanut butter in it, and the kid at home might be allergic to peanut butter, right? And that's not a particularly dignified experience that I just described. So what we've really encouraged all of our sites to do is make sure to essentially treat the food pantry like a grocery store. So you meet someone, you welcome them, you walk them around the pantry, and you make sure that they're taking foods that them and their family are actually going to utilize. And that's been really fruitful. I think it's been really good for our pantries. I think it's been really good for the individuals who use them. And as soon as COVID hit, we essentially had to tell everyone, stop doing that. You no longer can, you know, take someone into your facility. Now you have to think through how to go back to this 1970s model of doing some type, and in fact, going even further, doing some type of home delivery to people. There were obviously, especially at the beginning of COVID, with Matilda's Law and what was going on with the older adult population, there were a lot of folks who just were not leaving the house and needed food. So we needed to start to work with our partners to think through that stuff. And we don't have it down to a science yet. And, you know, I don't really want it to get down to a science too much because a time will come again where we will want people to be doing client choice. Client choice is not just good for the experience there, but it also encourages the facilitation of wraparound services. So if someone comes into a food pantry and they're eligible for SNAP benefits but are not receiving them, well, what a good place to start walking through the application. If someone doesn't have health insurance, what a good place to talk to them about the options that they have. So, you know, we had to change our model drastically by essentially asking our food pantries to think through home delivery. But most importantly, we developed a series of drive-through, touchless food distributions that have been taking place every week since March. So we're in month 8 now. And we're doing about 12 to 13 of them per week. FoodLink has a 10-county service area. 9 of our counties are rural, 1 is urban, urban being here in Monroe County. So the other 9 counties, we're doing 1 distribution per week. And in Monroe County, we're doing 3 or 4 distributions per week. And those have been seamless. I think they've been very good. Anyone can call 211 to register for one of them. And then we make sure that everybody gets a good amount of, if they're going out of their home and traveling to these places, we make sure they're getting a good amount of food with a diversity of product. And we'll continue doing that until we feel like we don't need to anymore.
Do you think that anything good has or will come out of this? There's that Albert Einstein quote, you know, in the midst of every crisis lies great opportunity. What do you see as the opportunities here going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know. I hope so. I think, you know, putting my other hat on as a city council member, I think that government generally has started to reimagine what their role is in some of this work a little bit, not just the food work, but just generally the direct service work to individuals. And I think that's a good thing. And I really do have a lot of hope that at the federal level, there's been a lot of talk about Build Back Better. And I'm hopeful that things, that systems that were really broken will continue to build back in a better and smarter way. From a strictly you know, food perspective, I don't know. I mean, the what I said before, I continue to stand by, which is that some of the systems that it seems people are leaning into right now and doing more of are the very systems that are not meant to handle this amount of need. And I talked about the food banking side, but I think I'll take this opportunity to just quickly pivot to talk about what we do in our commercial kitchen as well. FoodLink has a state-of-the-art commercial kitchen that we built out about 3 years ago. We've been doing this for 16 years. We built a truly state-of-the-art kitchen 3 years ago, maybe four now. And pre-COVID, we were doing about 4,000 to 5,000 hot meals per day, fresh, scratch cooked, all of them going to after-school feeding programs in the city of Rochester, predominantly city rec centers, YMCAs, settlement houses, places that are serving the folks that need it the most. And obviously with COVID, all of that changed. After school programs weren't really a thing anymore. After school programs are continuing to kind of try to figure out what their new model is going to be in the midst of COVID. But really the first thing that we did as part of COVID relief back probably almost 8 months ago to the date, because it was probably March 10th or 11th, I would guess, is we sat down with the school district, with RCSD, and we said, what do you need from us? What can we do? And that weekend, I think it was a Friday that the district said, okay, we're not opening back up on Monday. Everybody stay home. We had all of our staff go into our facility, and we started just preparing meals, grab and go. And we did about 5,000 meals per day in conjunction with RCSD and in conjunction with the city of Rochester, making sure that anybody could go to a rec center, anybody could go to one of about 20 of different school sites, and they could just pick up a meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner all at once if they wanted to. And that was really good. That was really powerful. As that school year ended and the summer started, typically we would move to what's called summer meals, which is any kid in this community can go to a rec center or a summer camp, whether it's a sports camp or a Bible camp, doesn't matter. They can go to a camp and they can get a free meal. Well, that looked different this year too, because of no camps. So we actually did something that I'm super proud of, and I think is a huge opportunity to build off of, which is that we actually partnered with the Rochester City School District and RTS, our transit authority. And RTS gave us five vans that otherwise were being unused and five drivers. And we filled up each of those vans with meals, grab and go meals in a little takeaway container, and a summer youth from the city of Rochester that we employed. And they went out on the truck and they just essentially treated these vans as ice cream trucks. But instead of ice cream, we were giving away a cold meal. It wasn't a hot meal because of the model, but a healthy scratch cooked meal. And it went so well. We were distributing well over 1,000 meals per day with that model by the end of the summer. Even though it's a little bit strange and counterintuitive to see an RTS fan and think, oh, I'm going to go stop and get my lunch there. In the end, we did the same routes over and over again so that families and children got to know us. And of course, the best part is they were being served by their peers, right? We were working with high school kids from RCSD predominantly to serve these meals. So there was a lot of trust built into the cake on that one as well. It went really well. And I had hoped that this school year, when summer meals ended and RTS had to take those five vehicles back, we'd be able to continue that work with the district. It hasn't proven to happen. And right now, what we know for a fact is that the Rochester City School District has usual in a normal year serving about 24,000 breakfasts and lunch per day. And they're well south of half of that at this point. I mean, there might even be a tenth of that. I don't know the actual number, but that's a huge problem. We need to figure out how to make sure that every kid in this community who typically gets free breakfast and lunch and after school meal has the opportunity to do that. And we should be building off of these home delivery models, but there's so many barriers in the way that, to be honest with you, I don't totally understand, because we're ready to do the work. If someone said to me tomorrow, can Foodlink make 5,000 meals and have them ready to go home delivery for folks, if we could provide the infrastructure, we'd be able to do that. But there's barriers in the way. And so I'm really concerned that even though we should be learning from some of these models, like what we did with RTS this summer, I'm concerned that actually everyone's kind of flying by the seat of their pants so much right now that I'm not sure what's going to be built back better in this space.
I want to just switch gears for a minute here and ask you about your personal journey to this place. And how did you get interested in food and social justice? And how did you come to work at Foodlink?
I can talk about that, but I could get carried away too. So feel free to stop me on this one.
Okay.
I had no idea or interest in this line of work when I was no one goes to school to be a food banker. How about that? I'll tell you that as a fact. I did my last semester of my undergrad and started to think through some graduate classes as a student at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And then I stayed for a while and I got really politically active there. There were a lot of things happening in sub-Saharan Africa. I spent a lot of time in Zimbabwe in particular, thinking through politics and political action. And, you know, in a place like Zimbabwe, I was there in 2007, 2008, when they literally were experiencing the highest rates of inflation in recorded human history. And what that meant was that there were actual lines at grocery stores. There was a shortage of dollars. There was a shortage of product. And I vividly remember, staying with a friend in Zimbabwe and going on offering to do the grocery shopping and literally having to wait in a line for bread to show up somewhere, a long line for many hours. So, you know, that still didn't spark an interest in me to work on this stuff specifically. But when I eventually came back to Rochester, I started to work as a Head Start teacher for Action for a Better Community on Hudson Avenue. And I was throwing away food every day, because the way Head Start works, it's a federal program. There's rigid guidelines. You have to serve 17 kids, breakfast, lunch, and snack. 17 kids rarely show up. So you end up with this surplus of food. And here I was throwing away food every single day. And I was throwing away food, A, because we were over-serving, but B, also because the food was not particularly good. And contrary to popular belief, no matter how hungry someone is, if you give them food that looks, tastes, and smells bad, they're probably not going to eat it. And that was happening on a regular basis. So it was driving me crazy, especially having just come from Zimbabwe. Like literally within months, I was waiting in breadline to now I was dumping food away. I had no idea what to do with this, but I was full of kind of frustration and rage and energy and passion to do something about it. And someone gave me the great wisdom to call Foodlink, who I had no idea what they were at the time. I called them. The person who founded Foodlink, Tom Ferraro, who became my mentor. Tom was the kind of guy who he took that meeting with 22-year-old me, who had some cockeyed idea about how to, save the world by saving the milk that I was dumping every day. And Tom asked me to come work for him. So I finished the school year and I went to go work for Foodlink, and I spent about a year with the organization. And I got a little bit frustrated, I think, because I knew what I was working on, but I didn't really understand what the root causes were. I couldn't really articulate why these problems were happening the way that they were happening. And I don't, you know, I still struggle with that, frankly, although I think it's getting more refined after 12 years. But I left the organization to go pursue graduate studies. And I ended up very fortunately getting into the University of Rochester. And I did a doctorate in history there, where I studied the history of food retail and kind of how these systems that we know of today came to be. And shortly after I started to actually do graduate studies, I got incredibly bored. I'm not someone who can, I can't study alone. It's a means to an end for me, not the end itself. So I called up Tom and he let me come back and work for him part-time. And really over the course of about 8 years, I had this really unique opportunity to both study at the University of Rochester and utilize FoodLink as a little bit of a laboratory on some of the stuff that I was studying, until eventually I finished my degree and I came to run for office because I felt that was the logical next step for me to be able to continue to serve the community. And all along the way, I've been with FoodLink the whole time. I want to just quickly, since I didn't get to talk about it before, I'll quickly pivot and just talk about how I used FoodLink as a laboratory. The thing that I think I'm most proud of in my career at FoodLink thus far has been the creation of the curbside market, which when I was a graduate student, a lot of what I was studying was about hucksters and peddlers at the public market. You know, these are people who would go to the market back, you know, before we had anything like supermarkets. They'd go to the public market, which was established in 1904. They would buy whatever product that they knew their community would want and need. And they would go back to their neighborhood and they would push the product down on a horse and wagon. And they would sell it to their neighbors, their friends, their colleagues, whomever the case may be. And it was not perfect, far from perfect. I'm sure we could look back at it now and be horrified by some of the food safety practices that were done back then. But the reality was that it was actually very equitable in the sense that our neighborhoods had individuals serving them, and particularly serving the communities that they that lived in those neighborhoods. So, for example, my family is Jewish. Most of my family lived up on Joseph Avenue, and there were Jewish grocers and hucksters and peddlers who would go up and down Joseph Avenue serving product that made sense based on the holiday, based on the time of the month, based on whatever the case may be. And the same was true of, you know, the Irish, the Italian, the Polish up on Hudson Avenue. And indeed, the African-American community had actually a couple Black-owned markets over on Clarissa Street, which was the center of the Black community in Rochester. And there was this real sense of, you know, people were able to take care of their own through food. And I think that was, I found that to be really, really, really powerful. And obviously we've gone so, so far from that at this point. So the curbside market was an attempt to kind of recreate the idea of a huckster and peddler. We would buy from, whether it was the public market initially, but then we would go buy directly from local farms, from producers, from wholesalers. And we would go directly into neighborhoods that we knew had a shortage of supermarkets, had no farmers markets, and had a real concentration and density of people. And so, you know, it proved to have worked really well. It's not a perfect program by any means, but here we are in year 7. It's grown every single year. More and more people, I think, have really grown accustomed to it. It's changed their ability to eat healthy. We've worked really closely with the medical community on some what we call fruit and vegetable prescription programs, where, you know, organizations, be it the health system itself, be it Excellus or an insurer, can essentially pay for people to get, you know, a preloaded card that is good for any fruit or vegetable on the curbside market. And they can do this in conjunction with a healthcare plan, with a diet plan set out by their physician. And we've seen people's health change dramatically. And on top of that, there's also like this really, just like with the hucksters and peddlers, there's this really unique social cohesion that happens because of the curbside market. We may go to a big Rochester Housing Authority site with a lot of individuals who never, you know, in a huge tower with hundreds of units who may never see each other. But every Tuesday at 11 o'clock, when we're there with the curbside market, people get to see each other. People get to, conversate around food, get to talk to FoodLink staff who are really wonderful and excellent about, you know, showing customer service. And that's been just a really powerful program. The last thing I'll say about it is that it also, we double people's SNAP benefits on it. So I talked about the power of SNAP, but you can even double that power when you utilize your SNAP benefits with curbside. And so that was, without trying to toot my own horn here, that was very much a product of the way that I was thinking as a graduate student and also being at FoodLink. And it's really paid dividends, I think, for our organization and for this community. So it's wins like that that have kept me in this work for over a decade now, and I don't see myself going anywhere anytime soon.
I love that the curbside market was inspired by the hucksters and peddlers. I had no idea of that history here, and to take that and kind of reinvent it for today's world is really neat. You mentioned Tom Farrar, who obviously was an important mentor to you. Do you have advice that you like to give to people who are interested in doing, you know, similar work to what you're doing?
Yeah, I talk to young people all the time about this. I can't believe I have to talk about young people now. I've never felt older, but I guess I've never been older. But I talk to young people about this all the time. And I talk about the fact that there is no linear path to being able to work on these things. I wish there was. I wish that, you know, the 18-year-old who set out to say, like, this is the issue that I really care about, and I'm going to develop, you know, the ability to work on it for my career. I'm going to focus my effort and my passion on it. I wish there was a linear path to those things, but there isn't. Everything is a little bit circuitous and circular. But there's, you know, especially in a community like Rochester, there's a ton of opportunity. So the question is, like, how do you get to the end goal, and how do you work yourself backwards, and how do you keep your mind open to be able to take new opportunities and work on different things? I think all that's really important, and I think it's valuable advice for people that, even if you are interested in, actually, I was just talking to someone the other day, a young person who's really interested in food justice, just graduated college and is working, got her first job working for an organization that's doing some, eviction prevention right now. There's as probably everyone knows, eviction is one of the huge things that we need to really worry about. As a result of COVID and the lack of stimulus from the federal government. And so, you know, she was talking to me about this because we have a mutual friend. And I said, you know, I can't think of a better place to get your foot in the door and to really understand what people are feeling and experiencing in this community. And yeah, it may not be specifically related to food justice, but you're really equipping yourself with skills and experiences that are going to pay dividends if this is the work that you want to do moving forward. And to keep an open mind and to be willing to step into those opportunities, but continuing to stay engaged, whether it's as a volunteer, as a staff person, in the issues that you really care about. So I think just knowing that things are circular and not linear, and opening yourself to other possibilities and opportunities, is exactly what I want people to hear. And I'll tell you that when I went into that meeting with Tom Ferraro 13 years ago now, I had not the slightest idea that he was going to ask me to come work for him. And even when he asked me to come work for him, I had not the slightest idea that I was going to actually accept it. But here I am 13 years later after leaving and then coming back. So, you know, it's just not linear. I guess that's the point.
So FoodLink is big on partnerships, and you have been a champion of lots of local organizations in Rochester. Is there one that you would like to kind of shout out or highlight that you think people should know more about?
Oh, there's so many. But I will tell you that right now, when it comes to food relief and food service, there's just a ton of organizations who have really stepped up. I would highlight the South Wedge Food Program over in the South Wedge has really taken a lead in terms of developing home delivery methods. I'm always inclined to talk to people about Baraka Muslim Charities, which is on Jefferson Avenue, and one of the most divested in communities in all of Rochester. There's Baraka every week serving food, serving individuals, regardless of, you know, if they are a Muslim-based charity, but it doesn't matter to them who the person is. They are there to serve. They offer a meal program. They offer a food pantry after school program. So really loving the work that they're doing. Beyond the Sanctuary is another one I would call out, is a ministry of the AMU Memorial Church in Cornhill. And Beyond the Sanctuary is very much about taking this work beyond the sanctuary and making sure that the church is finding ways to impact people's lives in various ways. And the young woman who runs it, Carmen Allen, is a real inspiration in this community. So, you know, if anyone who is listening is interested in getting involved, all three of those organizations certainly would be thrilled to have more volunteers as well.
And would you also say if people are interested in helping at either volunteering at FoodLink or donating to FoodLink, what's the best way to learn more about FoodLink?
Yeah, so foodlinkny.org. I do want to give a shout out to the United Way of Greater Rochester, who early on in COVID really took control and ownership of organizing volunteers across this community in a time where volunteerism was both very much people wanted to volunteer, but it was also really a difficult time to volunteer because there were so many unknowns about COVID and how to act, and the fear factor was so high at that point. So United Way was great and really helped us weather the storm early on. But now we are back, in fact, to scheduling our own volunteers. So we always have shifts that are available. You can go to foodlinkny.org to find out anything about those shifts. We also, of course, have the ability there for folks to make a donation. And we also have the opportunity to the ability to send you to a local organization, a food pantry in your community, if you want to give back in that way too. I talk about this with people all the time. There are, you know, I want people to really recognize that FoodLink is kind of the think of us as the wholesale network of the emergency food system. And there's also the retail version, which is the individual food pantry. And regardless of where you are in this community, it doesn't matter if you're urban, rural, or suburban, there is a food pantry near you that I can guarantee needs help. And so people all the time want to come into FoodLink to bring, you know, whatever came out of their cupboard, right? They have some extra food that they want to donate. We work in very large volumes and very large scales. But again, there's a Brighton food cupboard. There's an Irondequoit food cupboard. You know, on the west side, there's several food cupboards in Greece, all throughout our rural communities, in the city of Rochester. Everywhere you are, there are food cupboards. And if you want to get to know those folks, I'd encourage you to just, you know, look around. It shouldn't be too hard to find in your community. But of course, you can contact us at FoodLink and we'll connect you with an individual in your town as well.
And so my last question for you is that you were born and raised here in Rochester, is that right?
Yeah.
And then you chose to come back and you're raising your own family here too. Do you have a favorite thing about Rochester or things?
Yeah, it's a very easy answer for me. And it's very related to what we've been talking about. It's the public market. I think the Rochester Public Market is the single greatest place that we have in our community. I'll even tell you that my wife, Amy, and I got married at the public market. I thought we were going to be the first, but we ended up being the second wedding there. I'm not sure they're doing them anymore, actually. So we might be one of the only ones who were able to make it happen. But I also focused my dissertation on the public market as well. So I've researched that place pretty significantly. And what I love about it is very much tied into what I love about FoodLink, which is that, you know, one of the great things about food is that it's a unifier. It's an equalizer. The public market is such an amazing place because it is certainly the most diverse and integrated space, public space that we have in Rochester. And we do have an issue in this community, in my opinion, that we continue to be a very segregated city in a lot of ways. And the public market is a space where that kind of goes away. And at the same time, within the market ecosystem itself, you could be someone who wants to go buy a $10 artisanal loaf of bread, as you know, some of my friends are inclined to do, or you could be like me and be the person who wants to go to the market to buy the 25-cent package of Driscoll strawberries that if you don't use them in the next day, they're going to be moldy. I like the fact that there's that big range. I think that range is incredibly important. I think that range brings all sorts of people together. And in a time and in a space where we don't have a lot of places right now during COVID where you can go and see a lot of people smiling and be joyful, I think the market is an incredibly powerful place. And I encourage everybody who has not been there, if you're listening, to go and to just walk around. You can stay distanced from people. It's not that easy to stay distanced from people and shop underneath the shed, but you can walk around and experience it and feel really safe. And I promise you, it'll bring a smile to your face and good smells as well.
I think in the last year or so that I've been doing these interviews, I think the public market is the most common answer for what people really love about Rochester. And I think it just highlights what a gem it is, you know, in our community, but also that it can mean so many different things to different people, to your point.
That's right.
Well, Mitch, thank you so much for talking with me today. And thank you for all of the great work that you are doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And thanks for all the work that you all do. And anyone who wants to connect, foodlinkny.org, you can find my email address. And I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thriving Forward podcast. This podcast was brought to you by Kids Thrive 585 Inc., the Huckelman Center at the University of Rochester, and Rochester Regional Health. To learn more about today's guest, head over to kidsthrive585.org and click on the podcast link. See you next time.
The views, information, and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of their employers or funders.